Hello, listeners. Welcome to Season 3 of Genetically Speaking. This season is titled Voices in Genomics. Before the season began, we sought out the nominations of individuals within the ASHG community who are diversity, equity, and inclusion advocates while maintaining a career in research or clinical human genetics and genomics. We hope these conversations would provide a way to explore their perspectives and stories to learn how they balance their career work along with advocacy, allyship, or activism work around equity, justice, diversity, inclusion, and more. This season, we interviewed many outstanding community members, and we're excited to share those conversations with you. These conversations dive into their personal journeys, inspirations, and challenges. The discussions cover a wide range of topics, including early aspirations, the impact of family support on their careers, and the significance of diversity, equity, and inclusion in not only scientific research, but beyond. As we embark on this new season, we want to let you know that some of these content areas cover sensitive subjects and difficult-to-discuss topics. Rather than avoid these areas, we believe that open and honest conversations will allow space for people to better understand one another and connect on a more personal level. If you find any of these subjects challenging, please take care of yourself and feel free to skip episodes that may trigger anxiety for you. Your well-being is important to us, and we appreciate your understanding as we navigate these conversations together. Thank you for being part of our community. Welcome to the Genetically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Eli Robertson. Today, I'm speaking with Jay McCrite. Jay, could you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Sure. Thanks, Eli. I'm Jay McCrite. I received my PhD in genome sciences from the University of Washington in 2016. And after that, I kind of transitioned from doing research to science communication. I led 23andMe's research communication program for almost 6 years, and I'm now doing SciComm over at Verily. And on the side, I've done a bunch of blogging and public speaking over the years on everything from basic genetics to how diversity issues kind of intersect with science and research.
Well, that sounds really interesting. Thanks, Jay. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today. You told us just a little bit about your background quickly, but could you give us some more details about your arc from grad school to now and how you've ended up where you are?
Yeah, happy to do that. I did my undergrad at Purdue University studying genetics and evolution. And really, I was lucky enough that a random advisor suggested, hey, you know, you're a good student. You should do some summer research program. Suggested I apply to like a Howard Hughes internship and ended up liking the lab that I ended up in. And I was there for 3 years. And really, you know, that lab, I think, it was the one who suggested, like, hey, have you considered doing a PhD? So I admit at the time, I didn't really know much about what a PhD was. I was the first person in my family to get something beyond like a master's degree. But I discovered UW just because I was really aware of Mary Claire King's research on BRCA, and she was a professor there. So I looked them up. They seemed cool, one of the many schools I had applied to. And I also wanted a program where I saw the future of genomics really involving a lot of programming and statistics. And my previous background in undergrad was very wet lab heavy. So I'm like, you know what? This seems like a great place to end up. I want to learn programming to be a genomicist. And long story short, I realized I hated programming. I hated statistics. I honestly did not enjoy doing research in general. I loved learning about science and teaching other people about science, but I didn't like the day-to-day work of actually being a research scientist. So while I was in grad school, I was doing a blog on the side, honestly, just for fun. I liked writing. Through the blog, I ended up doing a lot of public speaking. And a lot of the blogging was around science because that's just kind of what I'm naturally interested in. But I've always been interested in diversity as well. So I talked a lot about the intersection of like feminism and science or LGBTQ health issues. And ultimately really realized like that's what I enjoyed doing. I enjoyed communicating science. So I was really lucky that my advisor at the time, he was the kind of advisor who did not see leaving academia as being some sort of failure. He really encouraged me to take science communication classes and to like pursue what I was interested in. So develop those skills throughout grad school. And when I graduated, I was very sure, like, this is what I wanted to do. So I was not applying to postdocs. I was looking for, like, some sort of science communication job. And honestly, I kind of lucked out in that I had been stalking the 23andMe job board, mainly because I was a customer already at the time. And of like all the businesses out there, I was familiar with it. I thought it was a cool product. I had seen for myself that, you know, it was scientifically accurate, but communicated in a really kind of fun, accessible way. And that was really my vibe, that it didn't, like, it was founded in science, but also fun and interesting and engaging. And ultimately, I just lucked out, and they had a role open up where they wanted someone who was a recent graduate student who really understood genomics and could basically be a translator between their scientists and more of their, like, communication and marketing teams. And I lucked out and got the role, and really that's kind of been the career trajectory I've been on since then, is really focusing on science communication.
That's really cool. So I think especially for trainees, when they're first starting out, people's careers often seem very linear and like everybody's got it figured out. And a lot of people feel like they're just sort of stumbling along. If you're looking back over all of your experiences, are there things that if you were able to go back in time, you would make a different decision? Or alternatively, are there any really great successes that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, man, I'm the kind of person I always wonder what if. I mean, even I almost didn't go to school to study science. My mom was an art teacher and I was a very good artist. I almost went to art school to be a painter. So just I always wonder, like, what if I had followed that path, you know? Ultimately, I think now that I'm older, I try not to stress out about the various multiverses I've ended up in, where if I had done something different. But I'll say, like, just to be honest, there was a long time I honestly regretted going to grad school. I think now it's harder for me to know for sure, because obviously I think having a PhD did get my foot in the door for jobs and has set me apart as, like, having that subject matter expertise. There are not a lot of people who can both understand genomics and do communication well and have that, like, synergy. So in the long run, I think it worked out. But to be perfectly honest, I went to grad school because a professor told me that I should, because I was smart and that made me feel smart and special. And, like, that is not the reason you should go to grad school. You should go to grad school because you actually really enjoy doing research, which I found out I didn't like doing. So, you know, there was a time I regretted it. I don't know if I still regret it. I think it all kind of worked out in the end. But I do wish I could have made just more informed decisions about, like, the labs I was rotating in. And I just, at the time, I felt like I had no idea what I was doing. And I think that's what most grad students kind of feel like. So if anything, I'll just say, like, you're not alone in that kind of confusion. And, you know, things do work out in the end, even if maybe you would go back back and, like, change something, or, you know, hindsight's 20/20, right? You always know what you would do differently. But obviously also things that, I'm proud of and thankful of. One of them being that I am really glad that I had my blog as kind of this side project throughout grad school. I think there are definitely some people in academia, there's this traditional view that, like, if you're not doing just research 24/7, you're distracted. It's not actually adding to your career. But for me, all the blogging and public speaking I did that was just out of boredom and for fun and extra is really what set me apart in my career when I was applying to jobs, that I didn't just have a PhD. I also had a successful blog and had spoken in front of audiences. And actually, like, when I interviewed at 23andMe, I was shocked because they didn't ask me a single question about my thesis or my research or my knowledge of genetics, because the fact that I had a diploma from a legitimate department that was well known was enough to vouch for that skill set. What they asked me about was, like, how did you get so many Twitter followers? And, like, how did you organize events in your department for, like, extracurricular things? Because that showed all those communication skills, people skills, management skills, that, again, that's what set me apart from maybe the average applicant. So I guess in retrospect, you know, I'm really glad that I didn't let people convince me that that was a distraction. If anything, it was, like, the most valuable thing I really ended up doing for my career. So I would just say, you know, follow your passions, follow what you actually enjoy doing and develop those skills, and listen to yourself when you don't enjoy doing something. Don't just, like, keep forcing yourself to do it because you think that's the prestigious career, that's what everyone else is doing, what you should be doing. Just like really listen to what you're interested in.
I think that's probably really good advice, because many people are told the same thing. You're supposed to do science all the time and only science. And it's very important for people to understand there's not just one way to be a scientist or to be involved in science and research. And there's no telling what skill sets could be the most important.
Yeah. And especially when we're in an environment that, like, not everyone becomes a professor, right? You know, it's a very narrowing pipeline. And so having other skills is just, it's good for your career. You can diversify and branch out and do lots of different things.
Well, one of the themes that we have for this season, tying people together that we're interviewing, is having at least some interest in promoting diverse backgrounds, equitable treatment, and inclusive environments in the enterprise of doing science and in scientific research. What do those principles mean to you?
Yeah, so DEI, or diversity, equity, inclusion, what it stands for, it's always just been kind of a core part of who I am. And I think a lot of that is just from my upbringing. To be perfectly honest, I grew up in a suburb in Indiana that was extremely white, extremely not diverse. And in a weird way, because so I'm half Greek, and that alone was enough to be othering in the town I'm in, because everyone was very like Western European Protestant type vibe. So like having Easter celebrated on a different day was wildly strange to everyone in my community, which in retrospect sounds wild, because I know as a white person, like, my experiences are nothing like someone who's a person of color who was going to that all white Indiana high school. But I think it made me sympathetic to that experience of being othered. And I especially felt that when I realized I was queer and I was very much in the closet throughout high school. Like, I was the straight representative of our Gay Straight Alliance, which is hilarious in retrospect. And it's like my friends knew I was, and I was a very outspoken defender of my queer friends who were getting bullied in high school, and like, you know, our principal didn't allow them to go to prom, and like, you know, it was Indiana in the 2000s. It wasn't a great place to be a queer person. And again, I think that just made me sympathetic to people who were being mistreated or excluded just because they were different. And I saw this happening and I hated it. And I think it also really started getting ingrained when I went to college, because, well, I should back up for anyone listening that while now I go by he, him pronouns, I spent 30 years of my life presenting as a woman. I was female assigned at birth. And when I went to college as a quote unquote, girl, young woman, that's when I really started getting exposed to sexism for the first time, really, in that people just frankly were shocked that I was studying STEM at all. I would sometimes give presentations on science and get like sexual solicitations that were just totally inappropriate. And like every, you know, standard experience for a woman existing in the world, like nothing that I'm saying is a unique experience, unfortunately. But that, again, it really galvanized me that I was just like, this is stupid that people are acting this way. And so I started just voraciously reading about feminism, and through that really opened my eyes to all the stuff that I was really oblivious about, where, again, I'm a white person in Indiana, like, I was really ignorant about racial inequality, disability, everything that's, you know, now part of like social justice. So I just started reading a lot and following a lot of people who are different from me to learn from them. And again, that was just like always my nature. Like, I love learning, and I think that's why I went into science. So I wanted to learn about this too, that like clearly people come from different backgrounds, they have different experiences, and your experience isn't how the whole world works all the time, and it isn't what everyone else is experiencing. So to me now, I feel like I don't even consciously think about it when I'm incorporating it into research. It's so second nature. It's like an instinct now, but I see that as an integral part of science communication, and that, you know, step one of any communication is considering your audience. And I need to consider, like, what are the background of my audience? Am I explaining things in a way that everyone's actually going to understand? Or is this language that only speaks to people who are really like me? Like, is it actually accessible to everyone else? It didn't start as a thing where it's like, ooh, I want to do DEI in science. It was just, I've always had that kind of like bent for justice and like wanting people to have like a fair shot at life. And that's kind of just trickled into everything else I would do, I'd say.
I think that at the root of a lot of those types of efforts is just that idea of not othering people and just letting them be accepted as who they are and existing in the world without it being anything unusual. What kinds of efforts have you been involved with over the course of your career that have been focused on that kind of inclusivity?
Yeah, a couple different things. When I was an undergrad, I founded our group, the Society of Non-Theists. It was actually for non-religious students at Purdue University, which, again, in retrospect, sounds kind of like silly as something you would need, but it was an extremely religiously Christian environment. And again, I came from a secular upbringing. And when I went to Purdue, I was shocked by how othered I was for not believing in those things. And I literally like had people, when they found out I was an atheist, like just suddenly look at me in fear, stop talking to me and walk away. It was like wild how, and I think like as a scientist, you know, like higher education tends to be a little more secular and skeptical and it's like more normal. But as an undergrad, I felt like demonic to these people and they were clearly scared of me. And I think that was something that I started like just pushing back on and like educating people that like, no, you can be ethical and not believe in God. That's like, we aren't eating babies or doing anything scary out here. So that started in undergrad. When I went to grad school, I was really involved, again, ironically now, but in Women in Genome Sciences. I was a volunteer in that group all through grad school. It was a grad student run group. So basically, before my time there, it was organized by grad students who were just like, hey, we need more women in the field. We need support for people in the department who are women. And I was president of that for a year. And that was all around both like providing community and like career development resources for grad students, but also doing a lot of like outreach to get like girls excited about STEM and like teaching them about DNA and those kind of things. So really active in that in graduate school. And then when I kind of moved on to being more of an employee in like a corporate setting, most of the stuff that I have was at 23andMe because I was just there for a long time. But I was part of like a kind of core group of people who just kind of cared too much, I would say. again, as someone who's just like naturally interested in DEI, found the other people who were like, hey, are there some things we can do better, both in terms of like the product and research, but also just as an employee in the company and feeling like you have belonging in the company. So while I was there at 23andMe, I was really active in getting a lot of those like core DEI structures set up. So like protocols, meetings, employee resource groups, like it was all very amorphous when I started and all very organized by the end when I left. I was also the lead for our LGBTQ employee resource group for about 3-4 years. And as the lead of that, I did a whole lot of different stuff. I was everything from, you know, community building and making sure other queer employees just had a space where we could talk to each other and support each other, hosting like fun events for Pride and like celebratory educational events. Some things more directly intersected with my science communication, like actual job there, which was like, if we ever had a social media campaign for Pride and maybe we wanted to tie it into like LGBTQ healthcare or like facts about sex chromosomes and why it's more complicated than you might think, I was usually leading those efforts to like develop the social media campaigns. And I would say the thing that I'm most proud of from those efforts was I helped spearhead a big initiative to just make the product more inclusive for trans customers, which beforehand, when you would sign up for a kit, it would ask for your gender. And by gender, it really meant your sex assigned at birth. And there wasn't really a way to separate that. And this actually was pretty important because, for example, if I would go in and say, okay, well, I know they want my quote unquote biological sex because they're going to be looking at my chromosomes. I'll list myself as female for those purposes. Then, if you would open up DNA relatives later, it would list me as a sister, a daughter, and if you're transgender, you basically could get outed to all of your relatives as being trans, which can be a really scary experience for a trans person. On the flip side, if I had listed myself as male, thinking, well, I'm a man, I'm going to like list my gender because that's my gender, you would end up getting a very awkward email from customer care being like, oh, we have a sex mismatch. Did your heterosexual partner spit in the tube accidentally and you swapped samples? Like, there's all sorts of assumptions going on that, like, clearly you can't have XX chromosomes and you must have made a mistake filling out the form. So this was something that our customer care team had gotten a lot of feedback on, and that, you know, trans customers, it was a really awkward experience. It was awkward having to explain themselves to customer care, and you don't know who's on the other side of the screen. Are they sympathetic or not? And so we had this big effort that took years to do everything from just getting buy-in that this was important and we need resourcing to fix it, and then actually figuring out, how do we fix this? Like, what's the best way to go about this? Because we do need to know people's chromosomes. Like, that's important for the product, but like having that nuance to make it accessible. So what we ultimately did there was, in the login experience now, it separates sex assigned at birth from gender. And so you can now set your gender, and that's what's going to be used for labels and stuff like DNA relatives. So you're not getting awkwardly outed or anything, or getting flagged for mismatch, but then we still have like the biological information that they can then use to, you know, make their products. So I know there's, well, I don't work there anymore, so I can't speak to like future things that are coming. There's always like more that can be done. I'll say, like, it's not that like each report is customized if you're on hormones or not or anything yet. Maybe one day it will be, but it was definitely a good first step in that, like, it's not like you get this product and your first experience is this immediate like, oh no, I have to deal with this right off the bat. It's now much, much smoother, and really just happy that I feel like the one kind of like lasting thing I left, lasting mark. So I'm glad that at least now for other trans customers, like, they'll have a better experience going through that.
You've worn a lot of different hats along the way. You were just talking about how you had helped try to improve the products at 23andMe, but you also had all these side projects whenever you were in grad school. How would you compare and contrast the work you've done within organizations to try to make the organizations better to the things you've sort of gone out on your own to do with the greater community?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the main distinction is with the stuff in like going out of the community, or I'm just choosing to do it, a blog, volunteering, those are always really fulfilling because it's, you know, something I'm choosing, I really care about it. I think it's a good place to spend my effort. It's some place where I feel like I can make a lot of impact. And it's something I really care about. Like, that's why I'm choosing to spend my free time doing it. I think with a lot of the internal projects, especially the things that are more like HR focused, like, you know, what's the protocol for updating a name of an employee that transitions while they're in the workplace, and you need to change their email or their Slack name or all the like things like that. I will say those seem to come out of a place of almost like self-preservation, where it's like, I need to do this because no one else is doing it for me. And not just to like benefit myself. Often it was also, ooh, I just had this really awkward, terrible experience. I don't want the next trans person to come through here and have that same experience. So I will say, like, some of the internal stuff, it tends to be a little more frustrating, I'll be honest. It's a little thankless. It's a little, you know, some of these things are pretty standardized now in 2023 of like, hey, if you're polling employees on what their gender identity is, what's the best way to write a drop-down form with options using the appropriate language? Like, those are the kind of projects I was doing for HR, but like, that's not my job, right? I'm not an HR person. And it also wasn't what I was specialized in. It was basically like, as I was realizing I was transgender and educating myself about my own identity, I'm doing this extra research on what's the best practice for how to talk about these things. It wasn't my skill set necessarily. Like, I was learning it because it almost felt like other people weren't willing to do that research because it didn't affect them. And so I will say, like, those things are a little more frustrating. And I think that's a really common experience that a lot of minorities who are involved in DEI work probably relate to, in that there's a lot of burnout for the minority who is actually affected, because they usually have to take it on themselves to fix those institutional problems, because, you know, it's not affecting other people, so it's not a priority to other people. So I do prefer the projects where it's like I can pick it, because I actually really truly I care about it, and I feel like my skill set helps with it, more so the ones that I feel like I just have to do because I don't want to be dead named on my documents, you know, things like that. Yeah.
So as a communicator, you have to try to make science accessible. And I'm sure there are a lot of people that would disagree with me, but my experience is that scientific results and formal science writing is often very dense, very dry, heavily weighed down in jargon. And it's not that the topics are too complex to understand, it's that it's not communicated for the lay community. How do you go about trying to take results that you think are interesting or people need to know about and making them more accessible to people that don't have that specific domain knowledge?
And first, people can't see me nodding voraciously at everything you just said. So I'll just say that that's what I was doing. Scientific writing, especially in like a publication, is very dry, very jargony. And I think at times scientists almost like we make it more jargony because we feel like we have to use this really technical language when we could just state it very plainly and it would get the point across to even other scientists more clearly. I would say the very first thing I always do on any project where I'm communicating something is I think, what's my audience? You need to know that before you do anything else. Am I talking to middle schoolers? Am I talking to other scientists? When was the last time this person maybe had a biology class? Like, what's their background, level of knowledge? If you treat every audience the same, and again, I think this is like a DEI thing, you're going to lose a huge amount of people. You can't assume everyone has the same background knowledge that you do. So just kind of first knowing, like, who am I talking to and what do they know? And then beyond what do they know, I always then ask, what's important to this group of people? What do they actually want? What would they want to know from this study? What would actually affect them in their life? And not just like a fun trivia fact, but like maybe teaching them about this concept could actually help them understand healthcare issues better so they can go to their doctor and, you know, ask better questions, or it explains something going on in their family. Like, what is actually important to this person other than this just being a stoic fun fact? Like, that's not going to resonate with the average person. So, you know, I try to think about relating it to everyday lives, using analogies that people would understand, storytelling, and also like showing the process of how the science got there and humanizing it. So like not just saying, oh, you know, we did the study on X and this was the result, but like, why did the scientists want to study that? Like, why was this a hard question? What stumbling blocks did they hit on the way, and maybe failures? And it wasn't this linear process. It actually had all these branches that failed until they finally got to this point. Again, just humanizing it and also showing that like the scientists behind the science are humans and they have their own motivations. Telling that full story always makes it more engaging than just regurgitating kind of like the end fact. You need to make it relatable and make the person, you know, actually want to learn it. Like, why does this person want to know this?
This has been part one of our interview with Jay McCright. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm your host, Eli Robertson. Join us next week to hear part two.